Hi everyone, my name is Debbie Chandrasekhar and I'm here with the Berkeley Political Review podcast, here to talk about satire and the history of political comedy. Now, it's impossible to do this without speaking about a man with many monikers, the Prince of Ancient Comedy, hailing from ancient Greece, Aristophanes. And to help us navigate the works of Aristophanes, we have with us today Professor Mario Tello. Hello, Dr. Tello, and thank you so much for sitting down and speaking with me today for the Berkeley Political Review. And for our podcast, Barely Political, could you introduce yourself and your scholarship to our listeners?
Okay, hi. Thank you so much for making this possible and for coming to talk to me today. So I am in three departments. So my primary department now is rhetoric. And I'm also in comparative literature and ancient Greek and Roman studies. And I would say that my scholarship is primarily centered on the relationship between the ancient and the contemporary. So I'm really interested in critical theoretical modes that can allow us to bridge the gap between the ancient and the modern world. And I work especially with drama. So I've written three books on tragedy, and I've also written a couple of books on Greek comedy, and I also have a forthcoming book actually on Roman comedy, which is gonna come out with Oxford in 2020, at the end of 2024, and it's called Roman Comedy Against the Subject.
Wow, thank you so much. All right, so we're going to be concentrating on Aristophanes, and he was a for our listeners, he was a comic playwright in ancient Athens, and he lived between 446 BC to 386 BC. And Dr. Tello, before we get into his works, what exactly makes him have the reputation he does, and what makes him like one of the most famous playwrights in ancient Greece at that time?
Well, actually, that's a big question, you know, and which was actually integral to my first book on Aristophanes called Aristophanes and the Cloak of Comedy. So why him and not others? So I want to reject the argument that there is something intrinsically better or superior in his brand of comedy as opposed to the brands of other comedic playwrights. You know, we know that he was just one of many, that there were many comedic playwrights who actually competed with him, you know, every year, you know, in dramatic festivals, because, you know, this is the context, you know, of drama in ancient Athens, that is dramatic competitions organized and financed by the state every year, at which playwrights, both tragic and comedic, compete with each other and receive the first prize. So we know that he had a lot of competitors. He explicitly talks about this in a lot of his plays, because, you know, in most of his comedies, there is a space called the parabasis, in which the dramatic fiction is explicitly interrupted and he addresses the audience directly, talking about, for example, what happened to his plays the previous year, why they lost or why they won. He also blames the audience for not having appreciated how sophisticated his comedy was. So just to go back to your original question, we do not know why he, instead of others, survived, because he's the only Attic, that is Athenian comedian, whose output survives, not entirely, but we have, how many, seven plays by him. No other comedian, we don't have any other entire plays for any other of his competitors. So the argument I make, you know, in my 2016 book is that somehow his self-aggrandizing, you know, mode of talking about himself, talking about the sophistication of his plays, was taken at face value, you know, in late antiquity, or even before, in the Hellenistic period, when the great works of classical literature, Homer, tragedy, and comedy also were canonized, and also canons, that is basically lists, you know, of the most important works, were compiled, the kind of self-praise that he introduces in his work was taken somehow at face value, and that's how he became number one. That's how he survives. Wow. Right?
It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. Kind
right,
of.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and I'm not saying that those statements, self-aggrandizing, should be taken at face value. There is, in fact, an ironical, a self-ironical dimension to it. Probably when he's talking himself up, he's at the same time mocking himself, right? Yeah. But, you know, the game of tradition, of reception and rereading, you know, has somehow tempered the initial ironical, satirical, you know, framing of those statements, which then were taken almost as objective literary critical judgments, and that's how he was able to outdo his competitors, at least in the perceptions of ancient critics, that is, of the people who actually determined which text made it to modernity after antiquity.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That was really interesting. Thank you. So, Aristophanes writes a play called The Nights, and that's what we're going to be talking about. And while it seems... initially, it could seem like a traditional play with heroes and villains. The delivery is going to be anything but. And so this isn't even meant to scratch the surface, but I'm going to give you a little bit of a rundown on the Knights before Dr. Tella breaks down who these characters symbolize and the historic background. So using what's in the play, we're going to be talking about the center is pretty much four characters. There's Demos, the master, Demosthenes, a slave of Demos, Nicias, another slave of Demos, and Paphlagion, and this is a slave who has influenced the master Demos, and then a sausage seller. So this play opens with two slaves of Demos, Nicias and Demosthenes, running away from their master, who has beaten them under the influence of another slave, Paphlagion, the one who has the influence. So Paphlagion is kind of irredeemable in this play, and we'll talk about that later, and basically convinces Demos to beat Nicias and Demosthenes and takes credit for doing their work. And naturally, Nicias and Demosthenes are sick of this. So they contemplate running away forever, but they have a few drinks, and instead a different stroke of brilliance hits them. They decide to steal Paphlagion's beloved oracle, which he's never let anyone see. And once they get a hold of this oracle, they find out that while Paphlagion's fate is to rule, it's also in the cards for him to be replaced by a sausage seller. And lo and behold, who else is going to pass them at this moment than the sausage seller? And he's hauling his portable kitchen, and as he's doing this, he's met with both Nicias and Demosthenes, and they begin to convince him of his fated ascension of power. At first, he doesn't believe them, but he can be convinced. And at this point, Paphlagion has also realized that his oracles are missing. Unfortunately for him, though, Demosthenes has already called upon the Knights of Athens and a group known as the play as the Chorus, and they rough him up and accuse him of corrupting the political system. And now I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Tella, who's going to kind of tell us how this ends and before that.
Yeah, so maybe we have to say a little bit about the allegorical framing of this play, which is pretty hefty, you know. For other plays, people have tried to suggest connections between characters and political figures of Athenian history, more or less successfully. And in general, I am skeptical of approaches that seek to map rigidly, specifically, a character onto a figure of the Athenian political context. But in this case, I think that we are really in front of a pretty explicit allegory, and Aristophanes, in a sense, he's inviting or even urging us to read it as an allegory, because Paphlagon, you know, one of the two politicians who are trying to win over Demos, is nothing but an allegory of Cleon, who was an Athenian politician, and if one looks at accounts of Greek history, modern accounts of Greek history, one can see that Cleon is seen as the first Athenian statesman who turned democracy into a radical democracy. And when I say radical, we have to be careful. By radical, they mean a populist democracy, you know. And of course, our ancient sources, when they depict Cleon as a populist demagogue, right, they use the word demagogue, they are expressing an elitist point of view, right? The kind of democracy that Cleon, you know, is a representative of, is seen by them as an expression of decline, a degeneration of what classical democracy a la Pericles used to be. But of course, from a conservative point of view, even Pericles was too radical, because he gave in too much. He gave too many rights to the people, to Demos. So I don't want to formulate a political judgment on the merits of Cleon. For example, in some recent, you know, productions of Knights, Paphlagon, that is the character who stands in for Cleon, is associated with Trump, mm-hmm. right? So there are versions of Knights that make Paphlagon into Trump, a Trumpesque figure. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, the portrait of Paphlagon as all, you know, the Trumpesque figures, like someone who's really vulgar, you know, who's not very smart, you know, who likes to eat, you know, who tells it like it is, mm-hmm. right? Who farts, who blurps, you know, you name it. So there is a characterization, a comedic characterization, obviously, of the figure of this politician. But that does not mean that in Athenian history we can see Cleon as a Trumpesque figure, that is a populist conservative, right? It's also possible that Cleon was maybe a Bernie Sanders-like type. Mm-hmm. And from the conservative point of view, you know, he seemed like an absolute no-no. And so Aristophanes, who, I mean, this is a little delicate to say, but we can probably say has elitist leanings, right? He's a playwright, he's literate in 5th century Athens, so he reflects an elitist point of view. I mean, it's very complicated, you know, to align, you know, an ancient comedian or an ancient literary author in general with, you know, a modern political affiliation, a modern political orientation, but it's pretty clear that populism intended as offering rights to the people is something that Aristophanes makes fun of. It's something that he constantly mocks. Mm-hmm. In fact, the conceit of this play is two politicians, Paphlagon and his adversary, the sausage seller, and we can come back to the choice of this character, you know, who are ready, who are willing to do anything in order to get the demos, that is, the people's approval. So there is a sense that politicians, you know, are ready to offer anything, to make all sorts of promises in order, we would say today, to win the election, because to win over Demos really means that. So this is a frame of mind that is part, you know, of a kind of non-political or apolitical frame of mind in American society. They are all crooks, right? We hear that saying by a lot of people, and we can, you know, investigate which people usually say that. My experience is that it's conservative people who usually say they are all crooks, you know, that sort of distance themselves from politics as such, that see politics as intrinsically corrupt. So Aristophanes reflects a little bit, you know, that point of view. And then I should also mention, because this is a very important issue for understanding ancient comedy, that for a long time, people believed, that is, took at face value, a story that Aristophanes hints at in this play, which involves him and Cleon, that is, the politician behind, you know, the Paphlagon directly. So according to Aristophanes, Aristophanes tells us that after he produced a play in which he attacked directly by name Cleon, Cleon took him to court for slander.
Defamation.
Exactly.
Defamation. Yeah.
So you can understand how fraught this becomes. Should we believe? Did this really happen? We don't have any external source that confirms this episode or not. But even if we don't know anything that proves the historical accuracy of this episode, it is significant because it shows that already in antiquity, the relation between satire and serious politics is really fraught, right? In the sense that a statement made in a satiric context, on the one hand, can get a pass, or should get a pass, because it's satire, so it's part of a frame that makes that political statement safer, because it's funny, it's comedy, it's mockery, so it should not be taken at face value. However, you know, something that is said in public, even if it's in quotes, in the quotes of irony, in the quotes of satire, it's still said. It cannot be prevented from making an impact, you know, on the people who are listening. Which, of course, is a problem that we constantly face today when some satirist, you know, makes some incendiary remark or makes fun of a politician in a way that is considered as crossing the line. And the satirist said, well, I'm just a comedian. I'm allowed to say what I want, and I don't really believe what I'm saying. And the politician who says, well, you actually said it, and that still as an impact, it stinks, it's painful, it's vulgar, it's offensive, no matter what.
Yeah, I think like modern day we say like comedic license and...
Right, but there are situations in, for example, do you remember, I don't know what you remember, what happens to that female comedian...
Kathy Griffin. Yes,
right?
Kathy, that's exactly what I was thinking about.
She got into serious trouble.
Uh-huh.
You know, they thought that she had crossed the line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? You probably remember better than I do.
Yeah, it
what
would be Donald. Yeah, it would be I believe like Donald Trump's beheaded like head.
Right.
And major fire.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was a comic conceit.
Yeah.
But clearly, you know, he and other people thought that that was almost a murderous, you know, intention on her part, which could have instigated other people watching, you know, to murder him.
Yeah.
Right? And she did lose her job.
Yeah.
So now no one, you know, has heard about that, about has heard about her anything for many, many years.
Yeah.
Right? So this is a situation in which, you know, the boundaries of comedic discourse, you know, become problematic, in which, you know, the fact that really language cannot be controlled, not even by the scare quotes, that is by a filter that allegedly protects the speaker, you know, from being taken seriously and consequently from facing the consequences that she faced, you know, those quotes really are not effective because something said in public, you know, always stings. It's like saying something negative, oh, you are ugly, oh, I'm kidding.
Yeah.
That I'm kidding does not
have
the power
as the previous
statement. To erase what was said before.
Yeah. All right. Since we're kind of bringing it to, like, what's happening, like, nowadays in modern satire now, I think one thing that really stuck out to me was the fart jokes, honestly, in the nights. I have one quote here that I just, this had me laughing for a second, I'm not gonna lie. I think it's a sausage seller when he's making his case to the council and to Demos on why he should replace Paphlagon. He says to himself, "As I was saying this to myself, a man whose arsehole had been buggered out of shape let rip a fart to my right. An omen from the gods, for which I gave them thanks." And end quote. And this is like this is not the first or the last of the fart jokes, the butt jokes, and just, you know, a general sense of what we would consider now vulgarity.
Right.
And I think nowadays in SNL and other types of media that produces like comedy and political satire, we don't see this type of vulgarity being attached with political comedy. And why do you think that is? And why do you think vulgarity was so tied with political satire in the past?
Well, because going back to Paphlagon, you know, there is the idea of a demagogue, like a populist politician, as being some kind of grotesque monster, right? So that's why the connection between the Aristophanic demagogue and Trump is so compelling, in a sense, because of course Trump is the guy who he claimed to eat a burger every day for lunch, you know, and look at his face, you know, you really have a sense of some kind of voraciousness, some kind of abjection of politics, right? Even if, with his usual racist tropes, called someone a low life, right? That definition was almost self-referential because, you know, he's an expression of political objection. And that's, and this objection, the fact that he speaks like the layman, that he uses profanity, that he has this Khomeini offensive battle against what he calls political correctness, really gives a sense of an objectification of politics. So I don't think that we've ever seen Trump farting, but, you know, that would be part of his persona as someone who says, "I'm like you," you know, "I eat a burger every day, I eat a hot dog, I don't go for sophisticated food," you know. And the idea of politics that you see in ancient comedy is precisely that, so a kind of assimilation to the lowest instinct, to the lowest appetites of the people. which of course is a very conservative mm-hmm. way of thinking, because, you know, it is predicated on the idea that the people, demos, is this crowd of laymen, you know, who can be won over only if a politician assimilates himself to them through this phenomenon of objectification. So I think that with Trump, you know, this kind of comedy really could work, that there could be a return to this nexus between politics and scatological comedy, for example.
Yeah, and I do, I definitely see, like, with, like, late-night talk show hosts and the ones who do usually like to, you know, play a part in political satire, they were the ones who didn't invite Trump onto their shows.
Because, in a sense, he was like them. Yeah. You know, Trump really was a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the difference between the kind of speech that he engaged in, a kind of non-speech or ridiculous speech, and, you know, the made-up jokes of Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
And that is an element that you can also perceive in ancient comedy. Mm-hmm. It's pretty clear that this rivalry between Aristophanes and Cleon, it's not just political, but in a, because Aristophanes has to compete for the approval of Demos too, because, you know, as a playwright, you know, precisely because he competes at the dramatic festival, he needs to have the approval of the Demos. So they are in the same position. So in a sense, you know, the vulgarity that Aristophanes ascribes to Cleon is the indication that he sees Cleon as a competitor, that is, as a politician who, by winning over the Demos, is becoming a comedian, is becoming a playwright.
Yeah, and if we can kind of bring it back to the end of the nights,
right,
where the sausage seller wins. Yeah, what exactly does that mean? Because then something happens to Demos. I believe he gets boiled down.
Yes, he gets boiled down, but that's a kind of process of rejuvenation.
Yeah, to remind our listeners, Demos would have been the master in this, and who Paphlagon and the sausage seller were trying to appease to.
So he's put in a cauldron, right, full of hot water, right, and then he becomes youthful and beautiful and clean again. So there is a fantasy of rebirth. And of course, the irony, one of the many ironies, is that this scene of rebirth is orchestrated by a sausage seller.
Yeah.
That is, by someone who spends his life in a butcher shop, right?
Yeah.
So, there are many ways of reading, you know, this finale. I can lay out just a few, because,
please,
of course, you know, literature never has just one answer.
Yeah.
And of course,
frustratingly so.
Right, exactly. That's something that frustrates students. But there is a kind of open-endedness to it, which is particularly the case with comedy, right? So, one possible reading is to see the sausage seller as an allegory of Aristophanes.
Yes.
And that is a reading that is compelling, right? Precisely because we know that Paphlagon... And there are other elements that suggest this kind of identification. So one reading is, don't listen, Demos, to Cleon, but just listen to me, you know, and with my poetry, I'm going to beautify you.
Yeah.
Right? But of course, you know, the sausage seller is also a piece of work too.
Yeah.
He's kind of a jerk as well.
Uh-huh.
So another possible reading is that doesn't matter which politician Demos chooses, Demos is gonna be deceived, he's gonna be fooled around, and in a sense, that's really what politics is
about. Because both of them
about.
Are kind of trying to bribe him at one point.
Absolutely,
right?
They
yeah.
do.
Yeah, they,
you know,
yeah.
they offer him all sorts of things. You know, so I don't think that the sausage seller has a superior moral standing, right? He's just more clever.
Yes.
I would say that...
More capable.
It's more capable. He can come up with more sophisticated and more subtle, you know, intellectual constructions, right? So at the end of the day, you know, the finale, we can say, remains open.
Yeah.
And let's also bear this in mind, that yes, Deimos is rejuvenated, allegedly is turned into a fresh, refreshed, cleansed figure. But how does this happen? With him being dipped, you know, in a cauldron full of hot water, which is almost like a murderous act, right? So that also sheds, you know, I would say, a dark light on the finale, which is also another interesting thing about Aristophanic comedy. Yes, it is comedy, but there are also some eerie, ominous elements. You know, there are some dark elements in this place. It's, yes, there is a final party at the end of this place, but these final parties can't entirely cover up or make up for some of the violence that we see previously. For example, there is a scene of cannibalism in another play called The Birds. So it's always very complicated to read comedy.
Yeah, it really is. And what do you say of, like, we were talking about comedic license, and we were talking about kind of the impact that comedians can have on society. Is it possible to assess Aristophanes' impact on ancient Athenian society? And how do we sort of do that? And how do we say that his political satire impacted society just as political satire impacts us now?
Well, if we go back to the anecdote that I was referring to, that is the fact that Cleon took him to court, even if we do not believe that that's the case, still indicates that there is a strong connection between dramatic discourse and the political realm, right? Probably these politicians, not probably, but most certainly, these politicians, not just Cleon, but also others who are attacked, who are mocked in this place, sat in the theater. So they were watching themselves being mocked, right?
Yeah.
So even if we do not have any direct evidence of responses in the 5th century to his plays, I think it is a fair assumption to say that what was said in this context, in the context of the dramatic festival, had some kind of impact. It did influence political minds. Something like, you know, the Saturday Night Live, or what's the show which used to be, whose anchor used to be Jon Stewart. You know, The Daily Show? The Daily Show, right. Jon Stewart many times says, oh, I don't have a political agenda. He said many times, but everybody knows he's a liberal. And it's true that he makes fun of conservatives and liberals alike, but there is a kind of liberal orientation, right? So even if he's a comedian, I mean, he does, we know that he does influence a lot of people, and we know that there are some people who don't watch the news anymore, which is kind of an old-fashioned thing to do, right? When I was growing up, we would watch the news on TV at 7 p.m., and that's where we would get our news from. Nobody, or especially young people, don't do that anymore, but they do watch The Daily Show, and so that becomes a kind of news show. So the boundary between serious political discourse and non-serious political discourse is very porous. You know, there is really a thin line between these two domains, which really shows you that you can't separate comedy from non-comedic.
No, because now political both of them talk. Are being viewed as like political discourse, whether exactly. it's serious or not. Serious.
Exactly. Yeah. Once again, because the kind of quotes that comedic discourse, yeah. you know, can capitalize uh-huh. on, are not so powerful. You know, going back to the Griffin episode, yeah. right? Mm. She thought she could yeah. do something like that, uh-huh. and that. You know, irony and satire, this kind of filter would no. protect her, but it didn't.
Yeah, that's very true. And so I would love to talk about your book, in yeah. which you kind of, you bridge this genre. Actually, before that, if you could tell us a little bit about the genre, old comedy.
Yes.
And what exactly, like, what's the historical context of old comedy?
Yeah, as I said, you know, and this is something that one can find in any accounts of ancient Greek literature. You know, comedy is seen as an aesthetic, a literary expression of Athenian democracy, you know, of a political institution that prided itself on two values, that is isagoria and isonomia, that is everyone can speak equally and everyone has similar rights, which is, you know, true and false at the same time. I would say that it is true insofar as we identify this everyone with the category of the citizen. Like all Athenian citizens, it is true, could participate in the assembly. So the assembly is the equivalent of the American Congress, mm-hmm. right? Of course, in the American Congress, there are representatives, you know, each, you know, congressman represents a district, represents a community, you know, of thousands of people. You know, in Athens was not a representative democracy, but was a direct democracy. Mm-hmm. So anyone could go to Congress. Mm-hmm. So imagine everyone really going to Congress and raising their mm-hmm. hand and speaking. But when we say everyone, we are just talking about free male individuals mm-hmm. who were Athenian citizens.
Yeah.
There were also women, of course, in mm-hmm. Athens, who were not allowed mm-hmm. to participate in the assembly. There were slaves, mm-hmm. many, many slaves, who built with their hands, you know, the great works of Athenian mm-hmm. art, right? And then there were also residents in Athens who were not citizens,
yeah.
right? So when we say everyone, we really have to be yeah. careful, because we just mean
Everyone.
We just mean the people who were part, you know, of the Athenian club.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. but, I mean, the question of citizenship is very important and is very much debated mm-hmm. in our society as well, mm-hmm. where, you know, we know that there are a lot of Americans who are not citizens,
mm-hmm.
who are undocumented. You know, and they also have the right
yeah.
to be guaranteed forms of political participation, mm-hmm. you know, and if you read Aristophanes, you do see this obsession with citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
You really have a sense, you know, of the political uses of citizenship, because, you know, when Aristophanes wants to attack someone, especially a politician, the first thing he says is, he's not a citizen.
Ah.
He claims, well, of course, uh-huh. we think of Obama,
mm-hmm.
right? And all the attacks,
yeah, the attacks
that Obama received because,
citizen,
yeah, right,
yeah.
the birth certificate,
yes, so, yes.
right? Which, of course,
uh-huh.
is something that Trump
mm-hmm.
kept using
yeah.
during his campaign, which is another indication that really Trump is an example of this
mm.
objectification,
yeah.
comedification
mm.
of politics. Because every time Aristophanes has to attack someone, the first thing he says is, oh, we all know that his mother came from somewhere
yeah.
else. that
like,
his father
like, he is not Athenian.
He's not Athenian. Yeah. Or he would say he doesn't speak like an Athenian.
Uh-huh.
He has a weird accent.
Uh-huh.
So this kind of xenophobia, which makes Aristophanes quite unpleasant also to read, is basically is something that suffuses the Athenian political discourse as much as it does ours.
Yeah. All right, yeah, thank you. So to kind of bridge, and I think we've kind of been doing that, but to kind of bring it to your book, because there's some insights I would love to know about, to kind of bridge old comedy to modern day political theory. And how exactly does that work? Because we have so many years, so many centuries in between that. How is it possible to connect those two?
Yeah, so this is actually the topic of my second book on Aristophanes, which came out in 2023, which is called The Resistant Form, Aristophanes and the Comedy of Crisis. This is a book that has a strongly anti-historicist position. I mean, if you read Aristophanic comedy, there are so many references to the original political context. That's why undergraduates don't like to read Aristophanes, because there are just too many allusions.
Yeah, you have to keep like a Wikipedia page open.
You have to have the Wikipedia page open. You need to have a commentary that explains to you, you know, what these names mean, who were all these characters mentioned. So undergraduates feel that it's not really possible to read Aristophanes continuously, but the process of reading is constantly interrupted, stalled by this need to look things up.
Yeah.
So I'm really not interested in this book in that. I'm really interested in the kind of political implications of language itself, right? So this is also a way for me to separate political meaning from intentionality, precisely because, as I said, Aristophanes has elitist leanings, you know, but I still think that his language, which is explosive, right, it's so full of unexpected turns and twists, right, which indicates some kind of dissensual orientation. So I can tell you what I do in the book. So there is a chapter on a play called Birds, where I argue the main theme, I argue, is conformity and democracy. That is to say, there is a danger that the kind of egalitarianism that democracy apparently offers, but actually rarely delivers, gets confused with conformity, right? With conformism. And that derives also from the fact that democracy casts itself as the only form of government that is worth pursuing. There is nothing better than democracy, right? Is there a form of government better than democracy? Probably not. But that is dangerous, because that means that democracy can allow itself to enforce even some anti-democratic, you know, ways of acting and thinking precisely by capitalizing on its status, on the fact that there is nothing better than itself. That's why, according to Zizek, for example, we have to deal with the paradox that there is apparently more dissent and more freedom under non-democratic regimes. Because, you know, in a non-democratic regime, you know that you are always, that you always have to create a space for freedom and equality. While in democracy, especially when liberals are in charge, there is a tendency to complacency, to say, oh, we're fine now, mm-hmm. Biden is back in power, mm-hmm. you know, and that complacency becomes a way to delay or entirely shut down the moment of reckoning
yeah.
with the problems that democracy yeah. cannot solve. In fact, Judy Butler wrote a famous article after Obama was elected in which they basically warned people not to get too content with what we achieved mm-hmm. and not fall into the danger of complacency that democracy can produce.
Yeah.
So then I have a chapter for this, on this play called Lysistrata, which is very famous.
Ah, yes.
Right? It's the sex strike.
The Peloponnesian War.
Right, yeah. So yeah. women. There is also a yes. movie by Spike Lee called mm-hmm. Chirac.
Oh,
like
yeah.
women decide to not to have sex with their mm-hmm. husbands anymore until their husbands,
yeah.
you know,
back
make
home.
Peace,
yeah.
right? So I tried to go beyond the idea of the sex strike,
mm-hmm.
which is a bit problematic.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also very sexist
yeah.
because it's the idea that sex is a kind of service
yeah.
that women should provide
mm-hmm.
to men. And I actually read this play more in light of border studies and refugee studies
mm-hmm.
because, you know, what we see in this play is women occupying the Acropolis, so
yeah.
occupying the Athenian, the main Athenian
mm-hmm.
political state, and then the man of the city going crazy and
yeah.
saying, look at what happened. We have to face a swarm of invaders.
Mm-hmm.
They actually use the word
swarm,
which of course is the language that was used, you know, during the so-called refugee crisis in 2015.
Yeah.
If you look at the first page, the front pages of British tabloids,
mm-hmm.
you can really see these pictures of refugees, of immigrants, and the headline is The Swarm. So I make the argument that actually this play can be read as a kind of, you know, parody, you know, of the nation securitarian state, which presents itself as constantly attacked by invaders when it's actually the one, you know, who that is preventing some constituency,
mm-hmm.
some constituencies like
yeah.
women in Athens from accessing what, you know, should be accessed by them, from accessing rights that are entirely closed off
mm-hmm.
by them.
Yeah.
So, and then I have another chapter on this play called The Women and the Thesmophoria,
mm-hmm.
Which is a strongly transphobic play
mm-hmm.
because it's about the story of Euripides, the most transgressive tragedian, who is told that the women at the only female festival are bad-mouthing him, and so he sends a relative of his dressed up as a woman
mm-hmm.
to spy on them.
Yeah.
But when this man dressed up as a woman gets caught by the women, by the cis women of Athens, a lot of transphobic jokes get produced. So my chapter is not just a critique of this transphobia, but it's also an attempt to see how the language can actually be interpreted in ways that, regardless of intentionality, are actually trans-affirming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely, like, I think there's viewers' responsibility, right? Or, like, whatever, as a
right.
consumer of, like, the media, of whatever, that we have to be able to not just take it as, especially now that we kind of consider satire to be a form of humorous news, It's right. even more important to actually be critical.
Exactly. You know, that you can be mm-hmm. critical of the intentionality yeah. that has dictated mm-hmm. some statements.
Yeah.
But we can also think, you know, especially in the case of an ancient author, you know, of the possibilities that language opens up regardless yeah. of the intentionality. A text always speaks regardless of the design yeah. that allegedly was behind its conception. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that it becomes really essential when we try to confront the pre-modern,
yeah.
that is a world that is so different from ours, and that has really horrible, sexist, racist, you name it, mm-hmm. ideas that can lead us to abandon it.
Yeah.
To decide not to read it any mm-hmm. longer. And so one way in which we can recuperate these texts is precisely by focusing on this textural richness that goes beyond those unpleasant ideologies that are apparently the only message. They are not yeah. the only message that mm-hmm. is there.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming. Yes, I had a great time.
Right, thank you.
Thank you so much.